to the 290th episode of Constructed Criticism. I'm your host, Mason, and I'm joined by my co-host, Spencer Howland.
Hogak One, reporting for duty.
And Trey McLarnon.
Howdy, everybody.
Wow, how time has changed things, you know? We're messing things up. We got a Star Fox reference. We've got some Southern hospitality. It's an exciting week here at Constructed Criticism.
That was a Star Wars Rogue One reference.
The real trick is no one in Nashville says howdy.
That was also a Star Wars reference.
It wasn't little Pippi the or Pepe the Frog, whatever it is from Star Fox?
Oh, maybe Slippy does say Slippy reporting for duty. I don't know.
That's what I had in my head. Huh.
Also, really sure that Pepe the Frog is not on Star Fox.
Star Frogs.
Star Frogs is a good spinoff game from, like, you know, the Dr. Thunder equivalent to Dr. Pepper. But you know what? We're not going to give you knockoffs of this week's episode of Constructed Criticism. We have an exciting episode this week. We're going to talk about how to build your own cyborg guide. That way we can save you all the money for having to get a cyborg guide from other places. Except, spoilers, you probably want to reference other cyborg guides. But before we do that, we're going to get to the point of the show this week, and that's always improving. The point of the show is you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And Spencer, how did you always improve this week?
Well, I got mana traders. I registered with Hogak, and I 4-1'd with Hogak. And I don't know if I'm supposed to not play Hogak. I don't know.
I think accepting Hogak into your life as your modern deck is probably the highest EV play you can possibly make at the moment.
So, like, I tried two versions of Hogak. And what I've learned is turn two Hogak is broken. And Hogak is broken. And, it's hard. Because I'm not the kind of guy that, like, looks at a deck like Hogak and says, this is me, this is the thing that I want to do. It's just not the kind of Magic that I enjoy. But I'm also the type of guy that likes to win matches of Magic, and then looks at a deck like Hogak and says, this deck wins a lot of matches of Magic. Maybe I want to play this.
And yeah, Hogak's in the business of winning, and business is booming.
Yeah, the booming is... That was an NFL reference. I don't know if Mason knows that. Anyway.
I'm one with the sports ball. I'm ready for Thursday. Kickoff game!
Anyway, Hogak seemed really powerful. We tried two different versions. We tried a Mighty Linguini's four-color version and then another version. I think that the non-four-color version was a little bit better. Just like, you already want Stomping Ground some percentage of the time, so like playing a Watery Grave and a Steam Vents is like pretty bad. But yeah, it's interesting. I think that I'm on a Tron deck or Hogak for GP Vegas, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that like I buckled down and just like was able to rent Modern cards for MTGO, which is something I haven't done in a while because MTGO sucks, and that's the only choice that I have to play Modern right now as a dad.
Yeah, I feel that. I just like the only real choice I have to play Modern is not a dad too, so I feel you there. Trey, what was your always improving moment this week?
I do think that it's important to let the viewers know that there was a challenge there for Spencer to see whether or not he could say the word Hogak 50 times during his always improving segment, and he did come up a bit short, so that is bad news, but was
are we doing
effort.
Shots per Hogak mention? Because, like, if so, I feel like our listeners are going to be in big trouble.
We actually had a Bojangles gift card for you, Spencer, that I wanted a PPDQ 2 years ago, but unfortunately it's got to sit on my desk here for a little longer.
Sure.
Yeah, you don't want to sleep on those Botato rounds. That's right, Botato rounds.
Trey, besides, you know, mentioning the okay people at Bojangles, how was your always improving moment this week?
Most of what I was doing this week was also Hogak related, to shock everyone. But this was, it was kind of a different situation where I was trying to help a teammate get up to speed on the deck. There was an MCQ this last week that I wasn't able to play in. But I had loaned the deck to a friend of the podcast, Tess, and was helping him try to get up to speed with the deck because he'd not spent much time playing that type of a strategy. And so it was interesting of like spending the week, like getting text about lines, getting text about hands, and then like walking through like what my lines of play would be and then talking about that with him. And it was great because I was able to like feel like I was getting playtesting experience while actually not having the deck in my hands and not being able to play. But still being able to walk through like sideboarding decisions and then like turn sequencing and all of those different kinds of things for the deck. It's been a lot of fun and also, I think, useful from my standpoint, as well as also helping a teammate.
Yeah, you know, it's always, I think it's always really helpful personally. I feel like I can tell someone or teach someone like things about the deck and be able to explain my thought process, because sometimes you like think stuff and you're like, wait, why do I think that? And it helps you just get a better understanding of something you kind of understood on like maybe a subconscious level, but you couldn't quite, you know, express.
Yeah, it's definitely different when you have to go back and try to articulate it to someone else. Like, it forces you to kind of, like, crystallize what your thought process is. Where, like, you can't just go on just intuition because you have to be able to communicate it to somebody else.
Yeah, even if the play is right, if you can't express it, it's not helpful to them. And it kind of helps actualize it in your mind. It also helps that, you know, it forms the thought so that when you're in those hard situations, you've kind of already done that before. You don't need to rely on instinct as much.
Yeah, and so I have found that useful, and it's going to be, I think, hopefully beneficial as I go into the MCQ that we have this week.
Yeah, my always improving moment this week was I played the MCQ that Trey couldn't play. I ended up getting 18th place after starting 1-2 and then winning out, losing out on Breakers for top 16. But my always improving moment was kind of related to that, where, you know, at the SCG, I guess it's 2 weeks ago now, while time flies, I also started 1-2 and then I won out. And then the same with this past weekend. And both times it was frustrating to get like the second loss so early in the tournament. But it's like, well, I'm still here. There's still things to play for. You know, in the case of the SCG, I'm still live for day two, even if it's unlikely. You know, same for like I'm live for prizes, as I found out after the next round at the MCQ. So it's like, okay, I can get my money back or maybe even a little extra. So just making sure to there's still games to be played. The goal, in air quotes, you know, of getting the PT invite and being allowed to go to Richmond, Virginia to play the MC, it might not be there, but there's still other things to play for, and I paid this money. I'm going to be here anyway because my friends are doing well, so let's support them and play this. And that was my always improving moment, was just kind of buckling down on that.
What do you think was different that made it an improving moment?
Because there have definitely been times in the past where I've just done kind of poorly at the start, and I have continued to play, but I didn't play my hardest. I was just kind of playing because I was going to be there anyways. Does that make sense? Like, at the MCQ back with War of the Spark first started, there was, like, a big thing going on near my house, so I couldn't get back to my house, right? So it's like, well, I'm going to play this event because I'm kind of just stuck here, so I'd rather, you know, spend 3 hours playing Magic with friends and doing this MCQ than spend 3 hours waiting through traffic, mm-hmm. right? And I didn't give it my, like, I gave it attention, but I didn't give it as if I was still playing for the PT invite, and I did that this weekend, and I did that with the SCG. The SCG is a little different because you're still live for stuff, but both times it's pretty easy to get down yourself, and just making sure that I'm giving it my all and trying to improve in that way and always play at my optimal best. So I kind of alluded to last weekend, something I want to work on, and I was able to do that again here and, you know, win out the next, I think it was a 9-round event, so I won the next 6 or whatever or something like that. I don't know. But just went out, played tight, and I was really happy with my play. And I was happy with my play, too, with the rounds I lost. But it's just good to, you know, stay dialed in, for lack of a better word. All right. Well, that's right. Sorry.
No, I like that. I think that it's good. Also, your description of always improving and buckling down makes me want to now get a giant gold always improving belt buckle for Spencer that he has to wear to events. Ooh. Like a comically large, always improving belt
like
buckle.
Like the size of like a T-bone steak.
Oh, that sounds good.
I like that. That sounds good. That's a Patreon goal.
Whatever. I'll wear it.
Of a Patreon. Yeah. So it's just like, don't tempt me with a good time. Speaking of Patreon, though, and Patreon goals, this show is brought to you by the good people at Oasis Games. So, Trey, let's hear that ad.
Hello, fellow Magic competitor. Is there any more vapid suck on your time than one of your dearest loved ones excitedly regaling you with the intricate details of their dreams? The only thing more trying than having to slog your way through the minutiae of them recounting of someone's actual life is to have to feign enthusiasm when someone tells you their hands were turning into snakes while they tried to perform basic mechanical maintenance on their leaf blower. If you're like me, and I think you are, then you blow right past those glazed over eyes and you tell your wild tales anyway. In short, last night I had a dream. And in that dream, all of my artifacts left behind a thopter and increased my strength as they shook off their well-oiled mortal coils. They also made gobsmacks of blue mana to boot. And as I lived out my nocturnal fantasies of being the High Artificer, I awoke sad to see all of the power had slipped so completely from my grasp like many grains of sand. I was then filled with overwhelming joy that I knew that I could make my dreams a reality with the good folks over at Oasis Games. So make your dreams come true by heading over to mtgoasis.com and prepare yourself for the your next event by using code CCMTG for 15% off your first order, and then you can use code WouldThatBeGood for 4% off every order.
Wow, that's so true. Trey said about my eyes glazing over him just continuing to tell his stories. It's really the dynamic of our friendship and how we got here today.
I've seen it many times, and I've ignored that dead stare and just kept on going as if your listening didn't have anything to do with whether or not I was going to continue talking.
Just like that ad segment. You know, I mentioned earlier that we're brought to you by Oasis Games, and we love them. We love their deals and everything. And just like Trey said, they're not going to be stopped by anything. But we're also brought to you by the Patreon. And oh, you know, a while back, we talked about how we wanted to do a call-in questions for the patrons. And what we kind of realized is that the patrons don't really want that. So instead of trying to force something down their throat, we're just going to bring back the Patreon question. So if you like the show and you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/CCMTG. There's a bunch of benefits there. They're all in those tiers. Feel free to message us if you have any confusion about any of that. But one of the perks of being a patron of $5 or more is you get access to the Constructed Critics Group, which is a Facebook group where we talk about deck lists. We post Cyborg Guides. We post the decks we're playing. And we just have conversations. But you also on there get access to the Patreon question thread. So Spencer posted, and our first question for the month of August is from Nicholas D. Nicholas asks, does Modern need a play design team? If so, what does that mean for the future of Modern and Standard sets? So I'm going to throw that question first to Spencer. Spencer, what do you think about the play design sets? Or play design team for Modern for future sets?
Yeah, so, you know, one of my very good friends happens to be on the play design team.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. Say Michael Hindy. So here's the thing. I don't think I think the problem with Modern would never be solved by a play design team. I think that they can do that for sets like Modern Horizons and have like have a special team dedicated to Modern Horizons play design. But it's probably not worth their time in regular sets. And I also just don't know that it would solve the problem with Modern. Like, the problem with Modern is I don't think that it has an identity as a format anymore, and that wouldn't be solved by a bunch of people playtesting it. They would just find even more problems with the format than we already find, and it wouldn't solve anything. My answer to the question is no, I don't think that it would solve the current problems, which is a lack of identity for a format.
Trey, what do you think about that statement?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure about like the identity of a format as a whole. I mean, I know that has kind of happened with Standard, where they tend to push a more like mid-range situation, I think, most of the time in that environment. But I'm not really sure about Eternal formats in general kind of having sense.
I guess
that like Legacy has an identity of like Brainstorm and Force of Will.
I was going to say, I think that Legacy has that, and maybe Modern does have that now in the form of like Faithless Looting Ancient Stirring Mox Opal Aether Vial decks. So maybe the identity is like the 1/0 mana card. So maybe I'm just wrong in that, and it does have an identity, and I just don't like the identity.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe the identity is just something that like a majority of players don't a majority do enjoy, and another half don't enjoy as much, you know? Yeah.
It's been interesting with Modern, right? Because like one of the things that's always been a check in like Eternal formats like Legacy and Vintage was that, yes, you had like unbridled power of the things that you could do, but that the answers were equivalents, right? Like Force of Will is a big time police to try to keep some things down that are going on. And Modern's power level from a combo standpoint has certainly like continued to be pushed and continued to increase throughout the time of the format. And they've tried to introduce some new answers with things like Force of Negation and stuff like that, but that it still hasn't gotten to that point where they're like the proactive threats that are there are certainly winning the arms race.
Yeah, that's very true. The being proactive is still like probably the best that you can do in Modern, as I consider registering blue-white this weekend. I kind of agree with both of you in a weird way. So like, here's one of my biggest kind of like questions when it comes to this is I think Modern Horizons was really good. You know, I think some things slip through the cracks. Like, I think Ren and Six is probably just a little too good. I think Hogak's too good. And I think Urza might end up being too good. And that's fine for things to slip through the cracks, you know? Like, I'd much rather them take risks and less have to ban cards than get bland sets that don't do anything to the formats. But if that's, like, what we're going to be doing, why do we want a play design team to potentially hamper this down? Let's just kind of need design teams when we need them for, like, sets like Modern Horizons, where, like, a set needs a design team. And then when it comes to set like Sandra and stuff like that, you know, be aware, be cognitive, don't parent like better Faithless Looting or whatever, you know. But don't focus too much on that, because these old formats, sometimes cards just kind of come out of nowhere and just change the format up. You know, these arcane spells are changing everything because of Lotus Field. And Lotus Field plus these arcane Twiddle Storm decks is something that I guarantee R&D, if they had a year, would never come up with. So we just find stuff, and we play infinitely more games than R&D ever has a chance to in the first, you know, 2 hours that it sets up on Magic Online or Arena. I just think it's a little unreasonable for them to, like, be expected to do that. And so, kind of like what Spencer said, I don't know if the payoff's there for, like, the manpower and the hours it would take. So,
yeah, I agree. And you might end up with a situation, too, and it's a thing that we don't really talk about with Modern a lot, is that, you know, Modern was a replacement for kind of this middling Eternal format, right? Like, we previously had Extended, and then Modern replaced that. And there's always a possibility that sometime in the future that Modern doesn't exist either, that Modern gets replaced by some type of an updated format that's there to bridge this gap between Legacy and Standard. It's been very popular up until this point, and it continues to be so right now. But, you know, I can see a future where a few years down the road where the Modern just doesn't exist anymore. And there's a new format that we don't even know about yet that's been introduced that's there to try to bridge this middle gap for a like, quasi-Eternal format.
I mean, they just introduced Extended again, right? It starts in 3 months?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, is they introduced a new format that was kind of doing that, right? It was making Modern into Legacy, Legacy into Vintage, Vintage into Lull, and then Historic was going to kind of be like the new Modern. But then they aren't seemingly giving it the support that needs to be a competitive format. So it's kind of like this weird...
Well, they're giving... The stores are allowed to run Historic events still, right? So, like, it's just not supported online.
Yeah, which... And maybe that's a personal thing where it feels like if it's not supported online, it's hard for it to get real traction.
Sure.
But maybe it'll just be a thing where it's, like, got more traction than, like, Brawl and Oathbreaker, but still, like, that kind of local thing, and then they bring it to online in a more competitive sense. Because while it's there, it's just unranked, I believe, is what's happening.
Actually, Brawl might be a really good example of something where it didn't have online support, so it didn't take off. So maybe you're just right.
Yeah. Aren't they actually adding Brawl too? So, like, I'm going to be very curious what happens when Brawl gets added to Arena in the next 6 months or whatever.
Yeah.
And then see if it kind of takes off, because there's a lot of people playing Arena. And Historic looks kind of cool, except for the part where it's just standard right now because they didn't go back and add the other sets for some reason. But they said they're open to the idea of adding sets, like, in the back end later. You know, maybe adding Amonkhet or Kaladesh. So
I don't think they realized how broken this standard was going to be. I think they could pretty easily add those sets now.
Yeah, I just want Hour of Promise, really. That's what it comes down to. Oh, I man. Love that card. I mean, I think we all actually love that card.
Yeah, that's exactly what Scapeshift needs, is Hour of Promise.
Yeah.
This grow from the ashes, don't need it. Hashtag Hour of Promise.
Grab my deserts, make my zombies for my zombies.
Oh, man.
Hey, bra, I heard you like zombies. Wow. I just cried a little because that's beautiful.
So in short, it sounds like that, as far as the Patreon question is concerned, that we're all in agreement.
Yeah, I just don't think it would help.
I don't know that having play design for Eternal formats specifically dedicated in that way is an effective use of the resources that they have available.
Yeah, I agree. At least in the current way they're attacking it, maybe there's a different way to do it that's more beneficial for what, like, the results they want. And I'm always down to try new things. I've always loved that WotC's willing to do that. So if they figure out maybe a different way to approach it that might get better results for, like, the time and people they put into it, I'd love to see that. And if Magic continues to grow, maybe that's just something that happens. They're like, hey, we love Magic. It's growing and making a lot of money. We want a Modern division for play design because we think this is a real moneymaker for us. So maybe that's something that happens. I don't know.
I just think Modern likely is going to go the way of Extended. Like, the format is not a good competitive format. And I think that a new... It's weird because, like, Extended never got the support, but Extended is actually just my favorite format of all time. Like, it was a rotating format that let you keep access to, like, your favorite decks for, like, an extra season or two. And it didn't get support because, like, kind of like block constructed, it was only relevant during the PTQ season. But I think that they could fix that with Arena ranked and make it work again. I don't know.
I have a question. You know, let's just take a second to talk about Historic here. Do you think you would like this Historic / new extended format if it never rotated? So let's say, for example, Historic, because as of right now, it's not going to rotate.
Yeah.
But do you think it would eventually become Modern 2.0, where it's like, hey, we print a push card here, a push card there. Eventually, you have your new lootings, your new ancient strings, your new opals. Do you think that's just like history's doomed to repeat itself? Or do you think that, you know, maybe those older sets, they were a little bit too pushed in design, and nowadays they kind of get it?
I'll let the old man answer first.
right, old man.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as you have an ever-expanding card pool, what you're going to eventually get is that the power levels get pushed in all areas, because you'll have some sets that are pushed for spells, you'll have some sets that are pushed for creatures, some sets that are pushed for planeswalkers, and that's not that big of a deal when you have a more controlled environment like Standard. But as you get an ever-increasingly larger card pool, then there's going to be interactions that you can't possibly have foreseen or think about that are just going to be really busted stuff, and you end up with decks like KCI and stuff like that that's happening.
No, that seems reasonable. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed the question, Nicholas. I know it kind of went a different way than what you maybe expected, but sometimes that's what happens with the Patreon questions. They go their way. If you want to ask a Patreon question, go to patreon.com/ccmtg and see if it's a lovely one to get to. But now let's move right into our training grounds. This week on the show, we're going to talk about building your own sideboard guide. Spencer, what is a sideboard guide? I've never heard of one, that thing.
Why would you lie on the show like that?
Because I set up a leading question for you to segue for people who don't know, and then people at home who do know go, 5 seconds of my life gone.
So now we've just extended that a little bit. That makes sense.
Yeah, existence is pain.
So a sideboard guide basically is a list of cards that guide you in how you're going to sideboard. So it's typically a list of matchups for the deck that you're playing and the cards that you take out and the cards that you bring in. Sometimes it's organized by the player of the draw. Sometimes it's not. But it's basically a guide to help you figure out what are the good cards, what are the bad cards in a given match, and kind of moving forward with that.
Trey, when you think of a sideboard guide, do you think of, like, how do you think about when it comes to serving a role? You know, Spencer kind of mentioned cards in and out, etc. What does it mean to you, like, for a sideboard guide?
I mean, when I'm looking at a sideboard guide, the thing that I'm trying to get an idea for is whoever it is that generated the sideboard guide, what cards they value in particular matchups, and also what cards they think are expendable in particular matchups. Not even necessarily that I'm going to do exactly what it is that they were doing, but I'm trying to get an idea of what their thought processes are.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So that's a great way to jump into this, because the big chunk of this episode is going to be talking about how to make your own sideboard guide. Because here's the thing that I think, I know that me and Spencer both agree on, I think I actually got the idea from listening to CC back in the day, because I'm a CC kid, is that I think making your own sideboard guide is super important, and then I love comparing it to someone else's sideboard guide. So I have an example of this. Recently, I played Humans at 2 events, and at the first one, I made my own sideboard guide. Then I got a copy of Dylan Hand's sideboard guide and looked at it and see how it differed. Then I got a copy of my friend Dylan Duffy's sideboard guide, and then looked how it compared there, and just kind of seeing where we all thought about it, because they had played Humans and I hadn't, and then kind of adjusting my review, decisions from that point going forward. So I think making your own sideboard guide is a huge level up moment. It's a great way to actually practice Magic without getting in a game of Magic. And Spencer, do you want to dive into why that statement I just said is true?
Yeah, I think that, like, one of the things that I think about when I think about building my own sideboard guide is kind of challenging my own beliefs. So one of the things that I think about kind of is, you know, when you're first building a sideboard, right, you just might have a list of, you know, 20 cards that you're interested in playing, and then you kind of have to whittle those down, look at your main deck and things like that. When you actually build a sideboard guide, you're actually challenging the cards that you have in your sideboard and saying, do I actually have enough cards to board out, enough cards to board in, and where are my weaknesses? And it can actually help you even construct your sideboard in a lot of ways. Is that kind of where you were looking for?
Yeah, kind of. I think there's a lot of what I was thinking was said there. The last thing I would add is, it's kind of like playing games in your head, though. It's kind of the way
I
think of it,
yeah.
which is a weird way to look at it. But basically, you're like, let's take, for example, Humans versus Jund, for example, right? And some universes, you might not want Aether Vial because they have a lot of discard spells. But maybe you want to play the game in a tempo manner, and you're trying to attack the foreign that way. So maybe you trim on Vials when you're on the play on the draw. You can adapt your thing from there, and you're kind of figuring out what the matchup's about. And then when you go into the game, you've kind of played some test games against Jund without having actually played the games, assuming you thought about it in the right way. You kind of took an honest approach with it, which I think is a big part of the sideboard guide, is being honest with your matchups, you know? Everyone likes to say their deck has no bad matchups, rest in peace, Amulet Titan. But decks do have bad matchups.
I also,
being honest with yourself, that's important.
I think you're also just being honest about whether or not you actually have a plan, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's really easy to just sit there and say, like, yeah, here's what my matchup looks like. I played, like, 1,000 game ones, because people just do that. I'm not sure why. But, you know, once you actually sit down and you think about your own sideboard guide and, like, building the sideboard and sideboarding the way you want, you actually have to, like, decide what the matchup is about. In that moment, you're saying, this is the things that are important, and you now have a plan. Like, we talk about so often how having a plan is important. By building your own cyborg guide, you are putting a stake in the ground and saying this is the plan in the matchup.
Yep, 100%. So let's hop right into the meat and potatoes of this. Trey, you kind of alluded to it earlier, so I'm going to throw it back to you. Where do you start when you're doing the cyborg guide?
Well, I mean, the truest place of where to start is you've got to build the sideboard. You know, you can't really determine what the guide is of what it is that you're going to be looking for until you have decided what it is that you're going to do as far as building the sideboard. And there's a lot of different schools of thought as to how to go about doing that. The first is kind of a thing that Spencer was just referring to and talking about, where you are identifying matchups where you have problems and you're pulling out cards that you think would be useful, and you normally end up with more than 15 cards, and then you're kind of trimmed down based on what you think is important in order to, like, find the right mix of 15 cards that you want to go about in order to establish what it is that you're going to need. And it's like, okay, this is what I have, and then establishing your plan of what you're going to do in those individual matchups. Another approach, which is one that doesn't get talked about a lot anymore, is elephant method for building a sideboard. And this is quite cumbersome, and it's something that takes a lot of effort, but it can be useful, and it's particularly valuable if you're going to be doing something at a bigger event, or if you're going to be doing something with a deck in an eternal format that you're going to be playing for a long time, because you can spend the extra time thinking about the deck, and it's not going to rotate out so quickly that you're not going to get value out of it. But elephant method, for those of you that don't know, is what you do is instead of looking at your sideboard and saying, okay, I'm going to build my sideboard, what you do is you look at the matchups that you're trying to face, whatever the metagame is for a particular time. So if you're playing in Modern, you're like, okay, we've got Hogak, we've got Urza, we've got Blue-White, we've got Humans, we've got to have plans for all of these decks. And so instead of building a sideboard, you look at, I'm going to build my game 2 60-card deck for all of these matchups. And that if I had unlimited access to whatever cards I wanted, this is what I would want my cards to look like. This is what I want my deck to look like for that matchup. And after you've gone through and done that, then you can start looking at what the overlaps are of what cards are there, and then using that information to build a 15-card sideboard.
I love it. So, Spencer, you know, kind of hear me. Let's talk about the elephant guide plan for a second there, since that is, you know, maybe something that people haven't heard about as much. So I guess I should start with Spencer. Do you ever use the elephant guide, and then how do you start tackling that? Because, like Trey just said, it's a pretty big commitment, and it's a kind of a, honestly, a daunting task when you first hear it.
Yeah, so elephant guide, I believe, is 1 green and 2. It gives your creature mm-hmm. +3/+3. And then it doesn't make an elephant when the guy dies? I'm not actually sure. Elephant method, though, is a really... it's something I haven't done. It's actually something that was talked about with my friend group a while back. I think we even did an episode kind of talking about it. But I personally have not... I have not done it personally. And one of the reasons is because, like, it doesn't really work with a lot of the decks that I play. So, like, a really good example of this is the elephant method works really, really well with proactive decks, because you're making a setup that sets up your deck, your proactive deck, in the best way possible each game. Whereas with a lot of reactive decks, you actually just need to change the composition of your deck. So I don't know, Trey, what about you? Do you kind of feel the same way as me on kind of proactive versus reactive decks with the method?
I think yes. I mean, the thing that I think becomes a problem is that you might end up, when you're doing a reactive deck, of having like pretty transformative things going on, right? Like, you know, if you have a you know, blue-white control deck or whatever, it might look a lot better in a particular matchup if you had a lot of creatures. And so, you know, you might end up in a very transformative situation that's not going to be very viable as to what it is that you're trying to do. But it could also lead you to surprising conclusions that might have you trying some wild stuff.
Yeah, I actually have had a lot more transformative sideboards than I have, you know, elephant method sideboards. Mason, I know that my elephant guy joke didn't hit home for you, but what are your thoughts?
I understood it was a magic card. I'm down with the lingo. No, I thought that was a very good and interesting point about it. You know, I was in my head when Trey was talking about it. I was like, yeah, this seems like something that might be better for certain styles of decks. Or, like, for example, I don't think KCI would probably benefit a whole lot from an elephant guide. I'm sorry, an elephant cyborg plan. Whatever. What is it called again? I got so confused.
It's just, yeah, elephant method.
Elephant. The elephant plan. Yeah, my sideboard hates elephants.
No, it's the Heffalump plan. We'll just go with the Heffalump plan.
The Heffalump plan.
My favorite part about this is that an elephant never forgets.
That was a dad joke. That was bad.
Alrighty then. Well, either way, I think it's a very interesting statement. I do think that's pretty true. So personally, I've done the elephant plan one time. And the one time I did that was Team Energy way back in the day.
Oh, that actually might be a good deck for it, for a reactive deck for what it's worth.
Yeah, because it's a deck that can play both proactive and reactive.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of does it all, and that's kind of the reason it got banned. And that was kind of part of the reason when I did the sideboard plan, because I was, like, pretty newer to competitive Magic. I was probably, like, 6 months in at that point. I was going to my first GP with this deck, and I guess it had been only GP of the deck. And I wanted to make sure that I was ready for, like, what I was expecting and what I thought would be coming, and I was able to, you know, build the sideboard with plans, take things out, see how things look. And I wanted to have, you know, this kind of, for lack of a better term, I think when the format gets more narrow, it's easier to have like these different decks you can slot into, and I think that's where the elephant plan really comes into effect. But let's move on from that, because I think we could do like a whole episode on elephant sideboard guide.
And we probably could just do that later. Yeah,
and it's also a thing that I think, like Trey said, it's normally more beneficial if like the format is more open, because you're going to dedicate a lot of time thinking about something like this, kind of like an unhealthy amount of time it will be in some occasions. And I think having a more narrow format is better. So it might be something that maybe we can mention again, like when Legacy time comes back around here in like 2 months. Let's talk about though more traditional sideboarding, which is just kind of, you know, building a sideboard, thinking about what you want in certain matchups, thinking about what the problems you're trying to fix. And let's throw that to you, Spencer, to start us off here.
Yeah, I think that as somebody who, you know, plays a lot of Jund and blue-white control style decks, if you kind of, like, think about things archetypically or even ramp decks that, you know, often play that control role, a lot of times you have to think about, like, what are the things that are beating me, and then how can I adjust the composition of my deck to address that? And so when building a sideboard and even a sideboard guide, it's like, okay, I think the actual starting point is, what are my bad cards in what matchups? And I think identifying those things first really help you build out your sideboard guide, because you're like, okay, I have 5 cards that are bad in this matchup, I have 3 cards that are bad in this matchup, I have 8 cards that are bad in this matchup. And it does a few things. One, it tells you if you need to change your main deck composition because you actually can't fit enough sideboard cards in, or if you have to punt a matchup. And I think that those are both really important when you're addressing building your own sideboard guide.
Yeah, when you're building your sideboard guide, and I guess, you know, by default, your sideboard, you know, in this kind of situation, how often do you find yourself putting cards in your main deck so that they can, you know, save sideboard slots and trying to help these matchups that you're having problems with? And do you find that's more common for a thing like Standard or Modern, Trey?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I think that I end up doing that more in Modern than I do in Standard, just because, like, there's more varied decks when you're not dealing with a Hogak-type metagame that kind of narrows and shrinks it, you know, that you end up having to have so much variety in your answers that sometimes you're like, okay, I'm going to afford to shave some points here, shave some points there, but I can add some of this to my main deck to make it a little bit less consistent, but I gain points in these matchups where I need to, and then I get to play, like, essentially, like, an 18-card sideboard, which is useful at times. You know, we were talking about doing that even possibly with the Hogak deck, and you've seen that at the MC where they, you know, there were people playing that were Leyline's main deck, but that, you know, that may not be great when you're in an environment where you didn't have open deck lists.
Actually,
yeah,
Modern fits this really well, right? Because, like, if you look at a deck like Blue Eye Control, right? Like, a typical sideboard card that you might play in the main deck is something like, you know, either Crucible of Worlds or Timely Reinforcements. And those cards are high-impact cards, right? Or if you look at something like Jund, you might play something like Kalitas in the main that would typically be a sideboard card, and that's another really high impact card. So Modern lends itself to, like, you play these cards that are never dead but are really high impact when they would come out of your sideboard typically, so playing in the main deck just actually, like, doesn't hurt you but helps you in a lot of places.
Yeah, when you have cards like as powerful as Timely Reinforcement in certain matchups, and it turns out they're just good, like, kind of what your game plan is, right? You're trying not to die, trying to control the board, and it's like, oh, well, this does all of that. It lets me set up my rafts, protect my planeswalkers, do all these things. When those kind of perfect storms happen, same with Kalidus, right? I want to kill their creatures and take over the battlefield. Hello, right? These kind of things happen. They're really big upgrades for these decks, because now they're getting, like Spencer said earlier, or maybe it was Trey, sorry, you get to play these 18 sideboard slots, right? Just your main deck has some sideboard slots. And I love that Trey mentioned the ley lines, because even though while it is open deck list, it's kind of like the reason that most people ended up doing the ley lines in the sideboard, and we're probably not going to see that in the other metagame. I think that's a great example of building your sideboard and building your deck, right? The rules of engagement were a little different there, But they're like, listen, this is the way we're playing Magic right now. We have open deck lists, and under those rules, we think Hogak's going to be one of the best decks. We want this card against that matchup. We're going to play it, we think, 25% of the time. Let's just put it in our main deck, have a copy or two, and then now sometimes we're going to randomly spike these matchups, and the rest of the time we don't really draw that many cards, so we're not going to get punished as much. Plus, it's passable, and enough matchups kind of makes it worth it. And I think that's a great example, and now you just need to find moments of like that when it comes to, you know, timely enforcements, Kalidus, Leyline of the Void for the MC, and apply them to your normal deck building. So I would look for that kind of stuff when you're trying to build your sideboard, and maybe there's a card you really want in a lot of matchups, and see if it can fit your main deck and your configuration for that main deck.
Yeah, I mean, another great example is, it's been doing this for forever, right, is that Jund playing Scavenging Ooze. It's like, look, we know we want a 2-drop. We know that we want to be doing something here that has some kind of an impact. And it's like, we just get to essentially, like, free roll.
You know, really, also want a way to stabilize.
That card was spoiled in that core set, and Jund was already the best deck in Modern in that time. And the deck didn't even play that card because it already had Deathrite Shaman.
Yeah. Wow, that's right. I forgot Jund had Deathrite Shaman for a little bit. That was, you know, that was a choice.
No, oh, they should just unban that card. Let's be honest.
Yeah, egregious. They should leave it banned. just messing with you. Let's see here, but let's kind of talk about...
Can we actually... that same question, I actually would like to talk about Standard really quick, because I actually do this in Standard a lot. Trey kind of said that he finds himself doing it in Modern more, but, like, I'm the kind of guy that, like, is totally fine playing one of Lava Coil in my main deck in Mono Red, or like playing 2 Lava Coils in the main deck of my, you know, my Gruul deck or my Teemer deck, because, you know, it opens up your sideboard so much when you just are like, well, I would typically want a removal spell in this spot. Let's just play the highest impact one. This is something I do in Standard quite a bit that I actually do think gives me an edge.
Yeah, I think when it comes to, you know, approaching this kind of stuff, you should be looking at it in all formats. You should be looking for chances to do it in every format. I think another example of something that we both did in Spencer was Gruul with Cruel Harpooner, right?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, we had 4 Cruel Harpooners on our sideboard. It's like, well, what if we just put like 2 or 3 in the main deck? And now it's like, oh my goodness, I have so much room for activities.
Yeah.
You know, I can fix these other problematic matchups. And I think looking at that kind of stuff is really important. You know, I think a deck like Jund Dinosaurs, to kind of take a moment to talk about Standard, it gets to play Shifting Ceratops in the main deck, and that's really a big game against the blue decks, right? Wherever they may be at the moment, you know, when you run into them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think looking for moments like that and just in all of your deck building and not only sideboarding is super pivotal. I agree with you, Spencer. I think it's a huge edge. Let's talk about cards that maybe we're planning to sideboard out that line up with cards they're doing in the opponent's sideboard. And also, kind of to go along with this, talk about cards that our opponent's sideboard in. So, Trey, when you're building your sideboard guide, do you ever go and look up what other people are sideboarding in against you and then make your plans around that? Or do you find yourself normally being a solo ship in the night?
Oh, I think the worst place to be in Magic as a whole is a solo ship in the night. You want to try to create as many opportunities to get information from as many sources as possible. With the amount of time that I have played graveyard decks and or combo decks, I definitely look at what everyone else is doing from a sideboard standpoint, because there are so many powerful, like, incidental answers, right? Like, do you want to be building your sideboard around, like, Assassin's Trophy or Nature's Claim or Force of Vigor, or, you know, if you're in a situation where you have, like, Spell Pierce or Flusterstorm or any of these other kinds of things, or Pact of Negation, like, what are people trying to do against you that you then can try to build a plan with? And, you know, it's been times like that in Standard too, like whether or not you wanted Ceremonious Rejection over Dispel or something else like that.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think, you know, you mentioned it there in a second. I kind of set you up for it, because I think this is a thing that I really preach, is that when I'm building my sideboard guides, I'll normally have in, out, and them. And then them is like generic cards that when I like look at 10 deck lists, they all seem to play. So an example might be, you know, I look at 10 deck lists for Grixis Urza, right? And they all have Leyline of the Void right now. So it's like, if I'm playing a deck that's a graveyard deck, I'm going to keep in mind that they have Leyline of the Void. So on my sideboard guide, I might put Leyline of the Void. That way I'm cognitive of their plans against me. So even if, you know, I know this and I've accounted for it in the past, it's just a great reminder in the moment. And I think that's one of the tricks of sideboard guides, is you're front-loading all of this mental effort that can be taxing at times. By making this guide ahead of time, you're not having to do that. And then looking at what they're going to do for you and putting that down and being cognitive of it lets you kind of refresh your memory, like, oh yeah, Grixis Urza is going to have Leyland the Void. I need to be cognitive of that. I'm going to make sure, you know, that I'm mulling into this card. Because sometimes it can be easy, especially if you're just copying a sideboard guide where you had been, right? It's like, I bring in, you know, these Force of Vigors because they have, you know, Thopter combo or whatever, and they play like a turn 4 Leyland of the Void because they just hard casted it, or maybe a turn 3 off an Opal, and you're like, oh no, I've kind of wasted this card killing two things that didn't matter. So, Spencer, when we're looking at like how other people are building their sideboard and attacking us, do you try to look for cards that maybe don't line up well game 1 that do line up well in games 2 and 3 because of what they're doing?
I think I mean, this might be what you're asking, but I think the first thing I do is kind of look at my main deck and see if there's like flex slots that like just get upgraded all the time. So like a really good example of this is like Grow from Ashes and Scapeshift right now. This is a card that's really easy to board out. You're just like, okay, like I just don't need this speed in game 2. The game's just not going to be about that. If it is, it's pretty easy to keep in. But it's like this card that's really easy to just upgrade. You're just like, okay, well like this is the worst card in my deck, and like there's this other card that I have in my sideboard is just always going to be better. And I think I look for those a lot in my sideboard guides.
Interesting. Well, let me reframe that question a little bit better and see if maybe I can get this message to you. Let's say your opponent has a deck that has no creatures in it, mm-hmm. right? And then post-board, they bring in a lot of creatures. Do you generally try to find yourself trying to like mitigate their plan to attack you? Like they're trying to zig, so you zig with them? And maybe you leave in a path or two with a deck that bring in a lot of creatures from a non-creature main deck?
Yeah.
Or do you... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I think that like a really good example of this is like Lyra specifically. This is a card that you're going to see like they have no creatures and all of a sudden they have Lyra. So like a really good thing to do is like to have a sideboard that might include something like Fight with Fire, where it's like if they don't board in Lyra, it can kill them. But if they do board in Lyra, it gets them. And so kind of... zigging when they zig is important, but also not zagging too hard, if that makes sense. Like I do both, where I like to hedge. I'm a pretty big fan of hedging, unless you kind of have to decide if you have the hard read on moments like that. And I've certainly been punished as somebody who has made a sideboard guide and I've said this is the correct way to sideboard and I'm going to do it, and then you know, had a path to exile that didn't kill anything.
Yeah, I think we've all been there. Trey, what do you think about what Spencer just said there when it comes to zigging and zagging and hard reads and trying to hedge? Is that you take it the same way, or how do you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very glad that he discussed zigging and zagging and then summarized that he does both of them, because otherwise...
Yeah, exactly. If you only zigged...
Yeah, no one wants to be around someone who's solo zigging.
So true.
But no, I think that it's important. I mean, there was a great, I think a great example of this, right, was Autumn's Imsi.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You had the mono blue deck and playing against the Esper Control, and it's like, okay, we got to side all of this creature stuff out, side out the essence captures, to get a side out all of this stuff because they don't have creatures. And it's like, well, you know that their plan post sideboard is to bring in these flyers that you can't beat. And it's like, so you just have to take the hit and side in these, like, she sided in, or they sided in additional copies, right, of their creature stuff. Not only not siding it out, but, like, brought in more. Like, okay, I know that this is their plan against me, and so I've got to try to do something about that plan, or otherwise I'm just, like, failing to use the information that's available to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Autumn's match is a great example. It was one I was wanting to segue to, so I'm glad you brought it up. Just like Trey said, you know, Autumn even mentioned this, I think, and maybe it was in their article, it might have been their winner's speech, I don't quite remember. But either way, it was the fact that it's like, I know that my opponent could very easily take out their Lyras and Thief of Sandies, and I just have four blank pieces of cardboard in this matchup. But I also know that if I don't have these four pieces of cardboard, I don't know if I can win if they decide to, you know, go back to the humans, back to the, I'm sorry, the creature plan in game, you know, 3 and 4 or 4 and 5, for example. So I'm just kind of hard locked into this, and knowing when you have to be hard locked in on something, even if it doesn't feel good, I think is a huge sideboarding moment. So I think this kind of opens us up though to some stuff I want to talk about that comes from more of that straying from your guide. So you've kind of made your guide, you've thought about the ways, you know, you want to approach the sideboard, the way you want to approach the matchups, the way they're going to approach the matchup against you, how you want to zig, how you want to zag on them. And then sometimes stuff happens and they just kind of throw you for a loop, right? Because what happens is, while there's all this information out there, a lot of people like to add their own touch where they have their own way of attacking things, right? Like you might see some humans players play Lavinia in their sideboard as a way to stop Hogak, right? Hogak players never have seven mana in play. They could never use their Hogak. And now suddenly because they had that, it interacts with your deck in a different way, and now you're suddenly thrown for a loop and you have to adapt. So when those kind of things happen, Spencer, how do you stay open in those moments?
You know, I think that it's important to realize that I think draft might be the best example of this, where you're drafting a deck and somebody passes you something and you think it's a clear signal, and it's not, because the person doesn't value things the same way you value things. So if somebody thinks the matchup is about something you're not about, it's time for you to adjust, and you have to decide, you know, what happened here, and how do I adjust from this plan that I set up for what I believed the matchup was about to understanding what my opponent believes the matchup is about, and then either deciding if my plan is better or if I need to adjust to their plan. And I think that it could be correct to sometimes not do that, but you have to actually put forth the effort when you see something that seems odd. The number of times where like people are like, oh yeah, I lost to this bad player because they did this, and it was wrong, and it's like, well, was it wrong? I mean, they beat you. Like, why did they beat you? Did they have a plan and you didn't? And was their plan executed while you couldn't execute your plan because of what they were doing? And you kind of just have to weigh things. Like, sideboard guides are not a lock. Like, I'm not locked into this plan. It's just a guide, and that's important.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I really want to hit on what you said there, because I think that happens to a lot of people where they're like, man, I played against my opponent last round, and they just had this terrible sideboard plan. And in game two, they played X card, and they did it again in game three, and I lost because that card's so terrible, but I didn't expect it. And it's like, well, you saw it in game two, right? And you didn't adjust your plan, so who's really the bad player? Because they're saying the game is about this, and you're saying, no, me, I'm right. And you're not adjusting to it, even though you kind of fell for this trick before. And I think this goes into something that we kind of wanted to talk about, which was, you know, reevaluating what you're doing if someone does throw you that curveball. And I really like that you said that, because it's right. Like, even if that isn't the 100% best thing the game's about, if your plan is lining up poorly against them, then they have no reason to change, right? Because they've changed their deck to attack you in a way you weren't expecting, and now suddenly you're not seeming to adjust for it, and then you refuse to adjust because you're like, no, that's wrong, in this matchup you do this instead of that, but they're doing that.
Yeah, so a really good example of this, by the way, if you listen to like two episodes ago, Jerry did like a deep dive on Jund with Brian, and Jerry talked about his hatred for the surgical extraction
Field of Ruin?
Not Field of Ruin, but the three mana dude that destroys the land. Anyway.
Fulminator Mage.
Yeah, Fulminator Mage. And it's really funny because he talked about how much he hated that, but it's like, when I'm constructing a sideboard and I'm looking at like something like Jund, my sideboard did include that plan. And my reason was different than Jerry's. Like, Jerry's reason was, I'm not going to win this matchup anyway, I'm just going to ignore it. And like, my thinking is, well, I'm not going to use these sideboard spots for basically anything at this point, so I might as well hedge and make them about this. And I think that one of the things that like people don't realize, you know, you can surgical extraction Glistener Elf and totally win a match on the SCG Tour. And, you know, I think that people underrate the fact that, like, you have a plan. And staying open to both what you're doing and then also focusing on what people's game plans in and what they expect from you is really important here.
Yeah, I really like what you said there, because let's just say that, you know, they kind of talk about how your opponent is another person who has their own plans they brought to the tournament, right? And in your thing, you mentioned how Jerry's like, listen, if I get paired against Tron, they're going to need to mulligan to two and have a bad draw. That's going to be my way to beat them, right?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to need to have a good draw. And so maybe Jerry, because of that, has another card in his sideboard that makes it different for a different matchup, and because he gets his extra points now. And then that thing happens across the entire tournament, right? People give up matchups all the time, so maybe the only card they have that matters is Surgical Extraction, right? And like, listen, I get it. Surgical Extraction, that ain't it normally in this matchup. But I have this other card that is completely terrible, and this card at least 1% of the time does something. This other card does it 0%. I'm going to take my chances, and I'm going to switch this up. And then people lose to that card, they get upset, and they don't adapt, right? And that kind of stuff can happen all the time. Trey, when you're kind of, you know, having these moments when it comes to sideboarding, would you say it's an art or a science when it comes to sideboarding in a game of Magic on the fly?
Oh, I mean, it's definitely art. in the same way that you should be open to all of the sources of information that you can get to ahead of the tournament, you should realize that your plan's probably not perfect and that there's going to be things that you're going to encounter that you didn't think about ahead of time. And so you have to be able to continue to think about what it is. You have to be able to take the information that you're seeing throughout the event, and you're going to have to be able to adapt what's going on in the same way that you have to adapt with that in the game. You're going to have to adapt in that way between the games as well.
Yep, I really like that. I have a closing statement to kind of go along with that one before we wrap up here. I was at the SCG. I was playing in Dreadblock Skelementals. My sideboard guide that I made said, put Oriok Champion in your deck. This seems like a great plan, you might be thinking, because it has protection from red and black, and the Skelemental deck is red and black for those at home. Then I played against my opponent, and they played Plague Engineer, and they named humans. And I was like, oh no, I have boarded in two blank pieces of paper. This does nothing. So I had to go back to my sideboard for game three and reevaluate, since I just drew cardboard that did nothing. It's like, okay, well, this card's really good, but I need to answer this other stuff. So while I think this member might not normally be in the matchup, I'm going to bring this card in instead. And just being able to flow and adapt, I think, is really important. Before I wrap it up here, Spencer, Trey, is there anything you two want to say on the topic?
Yeah, this is something that I kind of want to mention a little bit earlier in the topic, but one thing that I find really, really helps is providing cards that are high, like, we kind of talked about high-impact cards, but also we didn't really mention versatile cards. So, like, a really good example of this is something like Collision Colossus, where it, at its very worst, it is a 2-mana, deal you 4 damage, or, like, pump through this huge thing with my creatures. But sometimes it's kill your Lyra in a deck that shouldn't have an answer to Lyra. And understanding when, like, the format is about something like that and when you should include cards like that will really help you increase the number of live cards that you have both in your main deck and your 75 overall. Like, you know, how many times have you been like, you know, I want to Plummet, but, like, Plummet only comes into so many matchups. But actually, like, if you actually had Collision Colossus, you don't need the Plummet in your sideboard, or you can have the Plummet in your sideboard and also have a card that can speed up your deck against something like Nexus of Fate. And just finding those type of cards is going to give you bigger sideboard options. A really good example of this was actually us finding cards for Green-Red Devotion back in the day when we were all on the Team CCMTG. We had a Green-Red Devotion sideboard that was really powerful and gave us a huge edge, even against the Mono-Blue Devotion deck, where it became one of our best matchups. And, you know, finding cards that come in multiple matchups is going to make your job so much easier across multiple formats when you can do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's kind of oopsies that we skipped it, so I'm glad we didn't, you know? Those kind of cards are really helpful. You know, I think a good example for maybe something like Modern might be Collective Brutality.
Yep,
right?
Yep.
Yep. Awesome. Well, Trey, is there anything you want to say before we wrap up here?
Yeah, I just do want to tell one brief story about an example of what I was talking about when thinking about the reasons of why you're sideboarding and what cards people are valuing and not, and how you have to look at that and not just follow a guide, specifically when you're trying to build your own guide. In the Hogak deck, was talking about with Hess, talking about sideboarding plans in the mirror, and I was telling him that I would regularly shave 2 Bloodghasts when I was sideboarding stuff out. And then we saw the article that came out on Star City from Peavy, where he was saying that he cut 2 Gravecrawlers and left the Bloodghasts in. And it's initially looking at that and being like, well, why is there a difference? Why am I evaluating this card differently than he is? And the primary difference was is that in my deck I was playing Cryptbreaker, and his deck he's playing Hadron Crab. And so the Gravecrawlers have additional incentive and value if there's graveyard hate post-sideboard, because I can use them to draw cards off of Cryptbreaker because they're zombies. Where he has no incentive to do that, because he does not playing the card that gives him the payoff for doing so. And so that you might have cards that are different in your main deck construction that give you different valuations as to what's important post-sideboard. And so if you've got differentiations between what your lists are, it's important to look at what those cards are doing when trying to decide what's valuable.
Yep, I think that's really important. I think it's also touches on something that we probably should have mentioned as well, but we're getting to it now, that if you change your main deck, it's going to affect the way you sideboard, even if it doesn't seem like that at first, right? Because you're like, well, I just changed the cards in my main deck. My sideboard cards didn't change. Well, it's like, no, the context and, like, the way your deck is shaped and playing out is now different, even if just slightly. You might want to take the time to reevaluate your sideboard and figure out what's coming in and out. Because, you know, most likely a card you took out came out in some matchup before, right? Because it's probably getting sideboarded out a lot, so you probably switch it to something else. So make sure to go back and reevaluate these things. It's constantly adapting. It's constantly living. Like we said earlier, it's an art, not a science. So hopefully this week's episode of Constructive Criticism talking about sideboard plans was helpful for you. If you enjoyed the show and you want to give back to the show, go to patreon.com/ccmtg. Spencer, if someone wanted to find you and talk to you about how much they love the Patriots, what would they do?
Oh, man. If you want to talk to me about the Patriots, follow me at Spencer13Sports. If you want to talk to me about Magic or video games, that's Spencer13H. I've been streaming a little bit more lately. I had a really short stream this week due to my son. But, yeah, I'm streaming a little bit more. I plan to stream this week over at twitch.tv/ccmtg. But yeah, those are the main places to find me. You can find the show at CCMTG or like it on Facebook at Constructive Criticism.
Trey, if someone wanted to message you and talk about the GAC and how to attack, where'd they do that?
At TreyMC on Twitter.
And if you want to follow me and say, Mason, your segues aren't the best, but I love you anyways, you can go to at Mason E. Clark on Twitter, and you can follow me at twitch.tv/TheMasonClark. And we're streaming a lot of Legacy coming up soon here. I have a Legacy GP, and I'm Legacy player on a team, SCG, so a lot of Legacy. I know there's not a lot of Legacy content out there. We're going to be playing a lot of different decks. It's going to be a good time, so you want to make sure to check that out. And that's going to segue us into our wrap-up segment of the show, what we would play. And I'm going to throw it to Trey first this week. Trey, what would you play and why?
The GAC attack.
Oh, the Hogak attack?
Yeah, because it's totally broken.
Yeah. All right.
And that's what I will be doing
this
weekend.
Wow, way to give me a deep dive for the players. I guess they probably have enough Hogak information to last a lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I can't just every week be like, hey, GAC is great for these reasons. I don't know if you know this, but not paying mana for 8/8s is great.
Insightful stuff. What about Standard and Legacy?
Legacy, I would probably still be a show and tell boy. I do love it. I think that the deck is still competitive. And as far as Standard is concerned, I would need to spend some time with the Vampires deck because I'm hearing a lot of talk that it's the new hotness again. And, you know, I wasn't in love with it the first time around, but there have been some card choice changes that make me interested to spend some time with it.
That makes sense. Spencer, what would you be doing?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that, you know, Mason, I had years and years of Segway, you know, training. So I actually thought your segues are great this week, so don't be hard on yourself.
Oh, thank you. Would you prefer if I went with how am I such a cutie Patreon question?
No,
too?
That was the worst. I wish you had not posted that on Facebook.
Alright, well, I think that Patreon brings up a good point about how much of a cutie I am. That'll probably be the Patreon-only episode this month since, you know, I'm the host now. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Spencer, what would you play?
Yeah, so right now, when I look at kind of individual formats, and I think these will probably go up on the Patreon page, and then we'll have somebody post a sideboard guide, kind of a new Patreon benefit that we're talking about doing. So for Standard, I'm on Scapeshift. I talked to two people, specifically Mason and Matt, about this. Maybe it wasn't Mason, but anyway.
It wasn't me. Yeah.
But, like, I had a real problem at GP Denver where I wanted to play Scapeshift, but I was scared of what my friends would think of me if I registered a Scapeshift deck. And it was, like, a pretty big weakness of mine going to the Grand Prix. I saw Andre's list. I kind of mentioned it on the show with Caroline, but I saw Andre's list and was like, I don't have time to test this, and my friends would make fun of me if I registered Scapeshift anyway. So I kind of just ignored it. I saw Caroline before the event and was like, your deck is the sweetest deck here. I'm quite sure of it. I'm really excited to see how you do. And then, obviously, the deck did what it did. I believe the two best decks in Standard right now are Scapeshift and Vampires. You could not pay me to play Vampires, so I would just play Scapeshift.
I want to talk about what you said, by the way, real quick. I want to segue and give a bonus always improving moment. I have played so many decks that people have made fun of me for. Spencer, I love that you, like, realize that, and I hope going forward you'll register the decks that you love and you think are well positioned, even if your friends are going to make fun of you.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Just like it was Andrew Elliott did with Eldrazi Tron for months, you know.
Sometimes well, Andrew was wrong, but he would be right now. Eldrazi Tron is great right now. We can transfer into that. I am going to play one of three decks at GP Vegas. It will either be Eldrazi Tron. Yes, I said that live on the podcast. You can clip it, post it somewhere. Spencer said he would play Eldrazi Tron, regular Tron or Hogak. The likelihood of me not playing Hogak is getting lower and lower by the second. I'll be jumping into another Hogak league after this episode just because it feels like free money right now. For Legacy, I'm not entirely sure. I actually have been more looking at Pauper than Legacy lately, if I'm being honest. They're going to be doing Pauper MCQs now. You know, Pauper is becoming a more relevant format than Legacy. But it would be surprising to me if I did not just play something like, you know, Grixis Control still. I know that Grixis Control is falling off, but I just don't see Teemer Delver being the deck that, like, I would want to register. And the main reason for that, like, while you would think, like, Spencer loves Teemer, this is the thing that he would want to do, it's kind of tough. There are, I think, Delver decks that are now playing Gurmag Angler. I think there was one in the Legacy Challenge that 4-0'd with 2 Gurmag Angler. It was like a Ren and 6 deck. It didn't play Nimble Mongoose. That is something that I would consider trying out. I think it played like Abrupt Decay too. So like if I was going to try something new in Legacy, that would be it.
Love it. Well, for Standard, I would play White-Black Vampires. While I love the Scapeshift deck, it's a lot of fun. I think a lot of decks in Standard are kind of not going as quick as possible, say the exception of Dinosaurs, but I think you have enough removal, enough life gain, that you can beat those matchups when they don't gall to you. So I want to be proactive, I want to try and beat people. Plus, I'm going to give the great insight that everyone gives when it comes to talk about vampires. Man, Soren's a card. Wow. What insightful content you have. You too can hear that each and every week by clicking subscribe in the upper left-hand corner. For when it comes to Modern, I'm in a bit of a pickle. I can't get Hogak cards. So instead, it looks like I'm playing some Wurza this week, or Blue Eye Control, but most likely Wurza. I have a problem where in Modern, I kind of refuse to not be proactive. Like, I'm just going to be a proactive deck, and Blue-White does break that rule. Even though I think Blue-White is well-positioned right now, I kind of thought that for the last 2 weeks, it's hard for me to pull the trigger on a reactive deck and a MCQ, and especially like a smaller thing like Hogak, where even if I have plans for the Gak attack, Hogak's so good and so consistent, I might just not draw it.
As somebody who's played Blue-White for like a year and a half now, yeah. You should not play Blue-White. 0% should you play that deck.
Okay.
Like, Terminus is not good, and people think that that's the correct... Like, if Terminus is the correct way to build the deck, you just shouldn't play the deck.
Wow, Trey feels so validated right now. I can hear in his heart.
So Trey has been wrong in the past about this, but Trey would be 100% validated in this moment about that. I'm validating you. I'm saying that Trey is right now. I'm saying there were times when Terminus was good. This is not one of those times.
Word. So, that leads me with Grixis Urza. And the deck is sweet, really powerful, but my only problem with Grixis Urza is there's a lot of things that are incidentally hating on me, a lot of people looking at the deck, plus it kind of it's weird, the deck has like a weird fail rate, even though it's super consistent. I've got problems with Urza, I got to figure this out in the next 4 days. That's kind of where I'm at.
Can I ask you both a question on this, and this can kind of be the last question on the show, but I was talking to Matt Kling, who's secretly listening to the podcast right now. Hi, Matt. But what do you guys think of the Thopter sword combo as like the main win con in this deck, because it seems so mopey to me, but like everyone's doing it.
Oh, it's so good. So the Modern's all about like creatures right now, except for like Tron, right? And because of that, the fact that you just have 1/1s infinitely blocks and holds up the ground so well, the life gain is like pretty relevant. And then the trick is you just need something that's kind of efficient to win. And while you could do other things, this is just like a good little thing to have in this kind of deck. Like being able to Whir and Goblin Engineer for the combo randomly is just nice, and it kind of can just take over the games. Like I've played that against that deck a couple times now as humans, and they haven't Urza'd me to death. They just made 3 1/1s a turn, right? Mm-hmm. And then they trade off enough, they gain enough life, and it's just so hard for creature decks to overcome that. It's so hard for Jund to overcome that. Really only Blue-White is one of the main decks, I think, in the metagame that can overpower this game plan. And while maybe this isn't the final form of Urza, I think it's totally reasonable to be playing the Thopter Sword combo. I don't know what Trey thinks on it.
You know, I think it's good. I mean, I think that it does a good job of, like, bridging the gap to get you to survive long enough to the point that it can go infinite, just because it can do so many things incidentally throughout the course of the game. And then the fact that it just, like, oh, well, I assembled my 3 cards, so I win now.
And also Urza, like, the thing I think sometimes people underestimate about Urza is that its 5-mana ability is pretty relevant in the decks it's in. The cards it has cost low mana, and they're all artifacts. So basically everything in your deck except for extra Urza copies and Whirs are mana sources, right? And so you get to activate its ability a bunch, which lets you find this combo a bunch, but also just lets you kind of move through your deck. And so since you're moving through your deck so much, being able to gain life is relevant in those situations, and then being able to find this combo that instantly wins the game is very nice. And it's just, you know, I think totally reasonable.
Cool. So if people want to find deck lists for the decks that we would play, where can they do that, Mason?
Well, I'd also play Four Color Legacy, Four Color Delver, whatever it's called in Legacy Control. They can go to patreon.com/ccmtg, and they can come back to the show next week when we're going to be talking about another exciting topic. See y'all then.